Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Rick Rosoff is my guest today. Among other issues, we want to talk about North Korea. What most Americans really don't think very much about at any time, except when it makes headlines the way it has been in recent days. Tough to keep track of North Korea. Tough to keep track of who's ruling North Korea. Tough for me. The names don't roll off the tongues of Westerners very easily. Certainly don't roll off my tongue very easily. But I think an easier way to remember it is North Korea has been ruled by three Kims. Well, it might be very easy just to say Kim 1, 2, and 3. It's a little harder to say Sung, Il, and Un. Rick, is that a good introduction? I want to say one more thing before I let you jump in.
Got me in stitches. Thank you. But also very insightful.
I think Kim 1, 2, and 3 works a lot easier for most people. I mean, maybe the North Koreans have a hard time pronouncing Western names. I wouldn't blame them if they did.
I'm sure they do. I wouldn't want to be a Korean attempting my name or yours.
Americans botch my name badly. I could just imagine what North Koreans would do to it. My name is spelled all kinds of ways, usually other than the way it should be spelled.
But it's perfectly phonetic, like my surname, yeah.
I'm talking about both my first and last names.
Oh,
you know, you can use a PH or a V. You can use a L-E-N-D or an L-A or an L. Anyway, we want to talk about Korea. But I'll mention one more thing and then let you jump in, Rick, because you're on this issue all the time and you know much more about it than I do. But I think it's important to point out the last year, Obama's Asia pivot is pivotal in what's going on, pardon the pun, is pivotal in what's going on in North Korea. Last June, then-Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta announced that 60% of U.S. naval forces would be positioned in the Pacific Rim by 2020. 60%. Well, as I like to say, Rick, the real targets are China and Russia, and I like to add to that that North Korea is a convenient punching bag, and if it didn't exist, we both know it would have to be created. Anyway, it does exist. There's been an uneasy peace, an armistice, call it anything you want, since July of 1953. The whole damn business never should have started in the first place back then in June 1950, but it did, and it should have been resolved much more easily than it was, but it wasn't, and we have the situation that festus today. Is it possible we're heading for war? Well, I doubt it right now, but looking ahead, you never know what's going to happen. Rick, again, jump in and explain this to listeners.
Well, thank you. But first of all, I should acknowledge you're people far more knowledgeable about the Korean Peninsula and issues pertaining thereto than myself. You know, even here stateside, in addition to your own writings on the subject, you know, people like Greg Ehlich and Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Power and Space and so forth have been on this consistently. They deserve great credit. I may speak to the broader topic, you know, the Asia-Pacific pivot, but I do defer to people who spend far more time than I have studying the Korean issue. Supposedly, according to the British Daily Telegraph this morning, a front-page article appeared on the Granma newspaper in Cuba, the newspaper, the daily of the ruling party, the Communist Party of Cuba, by President Emeritus Fidel Castro. And I'm quoting from the Telegraph. Actually, this is Agence France-Presse. Quotes from the article stating that if a war breaks out there in the Korean Peninsula, there would be a terrible slaughter of people. Quote, in both South, North and South Korea, and the quote continues with no benefit for either of them. And the AFP account suggests that and they're quoting Fidel again here, Stephen, saying that such a war would affect more than 70% of the planet's population, end quote. And he goes on saying it's the most serious threat currently for a nuclear war since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, about which, of course, he has a lot of authority in speaking. So to frame it in terms of what the potential gravity, what the gravity indeed of the situation is, and what would occur should the situation get out of hand, I think I could think of no better statement by the longest living, former head of state, and one who was intricately involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, as a key player in 1962. That's the general background, I think, of what's going on. We have to recall, though, first of all, we have to lay aside some false claims and hyperbolical and hysterical propaganda tricks that have been pulled off in recent days. You know, for example, the Russian government, including Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, have dismissed the possibility that North Korea possesses missiles of the range necessary to deliver, according to Western reports, attacks in U.S. cities like, you know, New York, Washington, D.C., Austin, Texas, and so forth, perhaps even, you know, Okinawa, I'm sure they could hit, Guam, perhaps, but I think we've been subjected to another missile scare.
And even
the South Korean defense minister a couple of days ago, perhaps yesterday, stated that the missile deployments by North Korea are not aimed against the United States, just to, you know, to register that information again before we proceed any further.
Oh, absolutely, Rick. There is no question North Korea wants no part of a war. Nobody in that region wants a war. North Korea's missiles certainly could target Japan, target South Korea. I mean, the two countries share a common border with a 2.5 kilometer, I believe, demilitarized zone separating them. So it'd be very, I mean, you use artillery shells and you could fire across the border. Maybe they have a long range capability and could hit Seoul. I forget exactly where Seoul is. How far is Seoul from the DMZ?
You know, I think it's quite a distance, but let me look at a map. The good thing about doing an interview in the internet age is you can conjure up maps at will, right?
While you're looking at the map, let me mention one thing I left out of introducing you, and it was a very important omission. I didn't mention that Rick runs the very important Stop NATO site. Stop NATO is a site everybody should check on a regular basis. Rick provides his own writing there. He puts up material that he gathers from his research. It explains important things that are going on and how it affects the other countries on a global basis. Stop NATO, again, is an extremely important site. And, Rick, you certainly deserve a lot of credit for what you've done with that site for so long. Anyway,
thank you very much. I'm glad you didn't pay a tribute to my memory, because I see now that Seoul is in the northwest part of the Republic of Korea. That is, it's very close to the demilitarized zone.
So probably artillery shells just might be able to hit it. Again, neither the South or the North wants any part of a war. I don't think America wants a war in that part of the world right now. Doesn't Obama have enough wars on his hands right now, Rick? I would think
containable wars, if you will, and unfortunately you can have any number of those, no? I mean, the ongoing drone wars in the northwest of Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, counterinsurgency wars in Mali and so forth. You know, unfortunately, we have an empire that's designed to conduct war. And, you know, granted a major air war that uses up the you know, the armory or the supply of cruise missiles or, Hellfire missiles for Predator drones would create a miniature crisis for the U.S. But unfortunately, it is able to sustain ongoing military hostilities in several countries simultaneously. But you're correct in suggesting that any direct military confrontation with Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea, would be of such an order of magnitude as to be substantially more than what the U.S. wants. Or perhaps even could contain while, conducting military affairs elsewhere. However, you're alluding to the fact that if the Korean crisis did not exist, the U.S. would have to concoct something the equivalent thereof, and I think that's the case. And that if you recall, North Korea is one of the three so-called axes of evil nations designated by George W. Bush in his State of the Union address in January of 2002, months after the 9/11 attacks in the United States, and is one of those countries that flash forward 4 years in January of 2005, when then Condoleezza Rice, who was National Security Advisor for the Bush administration, was being promoted to Secretary of State. During Senate confirmation hearings, she mentioned a new category of targeted nations called I just want to get this right, outpost of tyranny. This is unbelievable terminology or rhetoric, but that's what it is, outpost of tyranny. And, Iran and North Korea made the shift or graduated to outpost of tyranny from axis of evil countries. In the interim, of course, Iraq had been invaded. But that the U.S. Needs to have bogeymen positioned strategically around the world in order both for its own military buildup and to rally neighboring countries in those affected parts of the world, to rein them into a U.S.-controlled military alliance, about which, you know, since you mentioned the Stop NATO site, it was roughly a year ago, Steve, that ahead of the NATO summit in Chicago, in May of last year, that NATO announced the creation of its latest military partnership program. And the first one that is not specific to a geographical area, as its very name suggests, that name is Partners Across the Globe. I don't know how many people in the world realize that the, perhaps I should say former North Atlantic Treaty Organization now has a military partnership called Partners Across the Globe, but it consists of 8 countries in the broader Asia-Pacific region, amongst which are South Korea and Japan.
Oh, indeed. You got the, I guess, 28 NATO countries. You got the partner countries, and you're introducing some terminology for me, Rick, that I'm unfamiliar with. While you were going on, I Googled "outpost of tyranny," and there it is on a Wikipedia site. That phrase slipped under my radar. I didn't realize that Condoleezza Rice coined it, but there it is.
My recollection is there are Cuba, Belarus, at that time Myanmar, North Korea, Iran, Zimbabwe. I think that's pretty much it. But if you'll note the situation, the location of the countries, there's one for the Western Hemisphere, Latin America, Cuba, one for Europe, Belarus, one for Africa, Zimbabwe. Asia, being the largest and most populous continent, of course, is one in the Middle East of the Persian Gulf, Iran, and then two in Far East Asia, Myanmar, North Korea. Myanmar, in the interim, of course, has been recruited by former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton into the U.S. camp. Been pulled away from orientation towards China and, brought into under the U.S. column. It's not inconceivable. Well, the U.S. most assuredly has a plan to do the same thing for North Korea. The only question is how it's going to go about it, through what combination of blood and guile and what combination of force and cajoling. But there's no doubt that the U.S. would like to win over arguably the last Asian ally that China has left.
Oh, I agree, Rick. I think the idea is to isolate China from its former allies as much as possible. And again, the ultimate targets in America's grand strategy are Russia and China, because they're the two economic and or military powerhouses. They're the ones that stand in America's way for total unchallenged global dominance. These other countries, most of them are pushovers, but, a war with North Korea, America could roll over North Korea without any problem, but there would be an awful lot of fallout. North Korea missiles could hit Japan, South Korea. There could be terrible deaths. I've written how historian Bruce Cummings described the carnage of the Korean War. I mean, literally the entire country, North Korea, was turned into rubble. Bombing targets no longer existed. There was nothing left to bomb. It was all rubble. You could go back and bomb what you already bombed, but you'd be bombing rubble. I mean, cities were laid waste, big cities, just countless numbers of deaths, and maybe 3 or 4 million people in that war died. And, of course, the process was repeated in the Southeast Asian War. Just absolutely terrible. And this stuff just never makes it into the radar of what I call the scoundrel media, mostly U.S., but Western media, including BBC, the other European media, that simply don't report these things accurately. But if there's another war, I mean, the Koreans certainly know enough about the past war. They want absolutely no part of another one. And, of course, nuclear weapons are very commonplace now. MacArthur, as you know, Rick, wanted to use nuclear weapons against North Korea, and Truman voted him down. Something like, if I remember roughly, something like using multiple weapons along the China border to create some kind of a demilitarized, irradiated. So I don't know what MacArthur had in mind, but Truman didn't go along with it, so it never happened. But literally, we could have had a nuclear war against North Korea, and just imagine the fallout from that if it happened.
Yeah, thank you for reminding myself and your listeners about all of this. I mean, it's a monstrous chronology. I was born during the Korean War, towards the end of the Korean War, and have lived in a state of almost uninterrupted warfare in that interim. That's 60 years. I mean, to the point now where there's not a large military operation going on, but there's the longest war in American history. You'll pardon me, I have a cold. The longest war in American history in Afghanistan is continuing. You know, regular drone missile attacks in countries we've mentioned, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. So it's been a 60-year cycle of wars, which and that cycle has only intensified since the end of the Cold War and the fragmentation of the Soviet Union. It's gotten worse, not better. And, you know, about which? North Korea, of course, does border both Russia and China, as you're alluding to. And during the war in the 1950s, 1950 to 1953, this was war on the borders with, at that time, nuclear Soviet Union and non-nuclear China. We're now talking about nuclear North Korea, nuclear China, as well as nuclear Russia in that area. So it's, the situation is fraught with tremendous potential for a conflagration, the likes of what the world has really never confronted before. I mean, in a sense, it's much worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. And, you know, North Korea, as many of your listeners know, is a very unique political situation, where it's not, you know, calling itself communist, Marxist-Leninist. It's always maintained a degree of autochthony, of separation and self-containment that is unique in the world. And has, during the Sino-Soviet conflict, position itself, pardon me, intermediate between both China and the Soviet Union, you know, receiving benefits from both, but not particularly siding with either. And as a result, I'm sure that neither Russia nor China are eager to enter the fray, as China did, you know, last time after the U.S. encroachments to its border during the first Korean War.
Well,
I hope the only Korean War.
Indeed, the only one, hopefully, Rick. I do remember it. I was a freshman and sophomore in college, and I can remember we used to talk, students would talk to each other, and a common phrase that stuck in my mind was, there was a draft back in those days. I mean, we could be drafted. If you got out of high school and you didn't go on to college, your number could come up and you could be drafted. And the comment that I remember being repeated a number of times was, we needed to keep our grades up, otherwise we might end up in the frozen chosen in that frigid north cold area. And I mean, that war was a brutal war for anybody that was involved in it, and the last thing we wanted to do was get involved in it. So another one would be far worse than the first one. Well, you could do the same amount of killing in a much shorter space of time, and that's exactly what might happen. But the prospect of it is very, very chilling, Rick.
Yeah, to pick up, you're correct, absolutely. To pick up on a point we had, touched on earlier, we have to remember that the war in Korea, this is where the U.S. essentially provoked a walkout by the Soviet ambassador to the newly formed, at that time, United Nations organization over the question of, recognition of the government of China, with the U.S. supporting the, the Republic Taiwan, as opposed to mainland China, a position the U.S. didn't reverse, of course, until the 1970s. And, provoking that walkout by the Soviet envoy, the U.S. then rallied its allies and whoever could bribe or bully into voting a resolution for military intervention in Korea, hence the Korean War. And this occurred immediately on the heels of, the so-called Truman, this is, the ultimate manifestation of the Truman Doctrine, which had earlier been applied after World War II to Greece and Turkey, ostensibly to stamp out communist insurgencies, but in fact to establish political control over those countries, where, particularly in Greece during World War II, you'd had a communist-led partisan movement, which had tremendous support in the population. U.S. had to wipe that out, and it did, assisted in doing so with Britain during the Greek Civil War, but having, consolidated Greece and Turkey as outposts against the Soviet Union in southeastern Europe, and then the U.S. then moved to confront China and the Soviet Union and Korea, but use the United Nations to do so, much as it did 2 years ago with Libya, and much as it would like to have done with Syria, but for the fact that Russia and China belatedly, vetoed three resolutions designed to repeat the Libyan scenario in Syria. But another thing that's important to realize about the First Korean War, because the same dynamic is playing itself out now, is that the troops from Greece and Turkey were deployed to Korea under so-called United Nations command, and in essence U.S. command, as were troops from most of the founding members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization at that time, which had only been founded a year earlier, 1949. And in fact, the Korean War was used as a testing ground for NATO. Northeast Asia was used for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And as a result of Turkey and Greece sending troops under U.S. command for combat operations, the two of them were inducted into NATO shortly thereafter. Also, as a result of the war in Korea, the U.S. Set up a number of other military alliances it controlled, modeled after NATO, and those included Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, CENTO Organization, formerly the Baghdad Pact, the Australia-New Zealand-U.S. Organization, and so forth, all of which are being revived in the post-Cold War period, where there is no Soviet Union. And as we alluded to earlier with the so-called Partners Across the Globe program, is that the U.S. is now, rather than reviving all of these Cold War military blocs independently, it's basically reviving those in the Asia-Pacific region and integrating them with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So you're talking about the elaboration of a global military bloc under U.S. Control. That is probably the most significant fact of the post-Cold War period.
Oh, it sure is. And NATO, Washington-led NATO, of course, Rick, is involved in all of America's wars. So you've got Turkey, a belligerent, a direct belligerent, well, a direct belligerent, bordering on Syria, directly involved in a Syria situation, CIA forces stationed there, so-called rebels, I call them death squads, thousands of foreign fighters based inside Turkey, funneling them across the border, weapons coming across the Turkish border. So Turkey, a NATO country, very, very much involved in Washington's war on Syria. If something breaks out against Iran, you could see exactly the same thing. Arab states, along with Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel is involved in all of this as well. I guess Israel is a NATO partner country now. Is that right, Rick?
It is a preeminent NATO partner country under what's called the Mediterranean Dialogue, which is a 1990s founded or a program founded in the 1990s that incorporates seven countries in the North Africa in the Middle East, but it was the first to be given an advanced individual partnership program under the Mediterranean Dialogue, with Egypt and Jordan and other countries following. So yes, Israel is, it is a matter of fact, people should know, Israel is the only country outside of Europe currently that is in the area of responsibility of the Pentagon's European Command. The European Command's top commander is also the Supreme Allied Commander Europe for NATO. They're one and the same, so it's hard to distinguish, truthfully, the European Command from NATO. They're in essence one and the same, and Israel is the only country outside of Europe that is in the area of responsibility of the European Command, hence of NATO. So it has a very unique relationship with NATO. We should also mention the two of the brutal, medieval, benighted Persian Gulf nations that played a leading role in the war against Libya 2 years ago, and in the interim in the war against Syria, Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, are members of a NATO program called the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, set up in 2004. Both Qatar and the United Arab Emirates supplied between them dozens of advanced warplanes for the aerial onslaught against Libya 2 years ago, and are now supplying advisors, weaponry, and who knows what else for the foreign subversion campaign against Syria. So NATO's partnerships are not one simply of using countries outside of the Euro-Atlantic sphere, for logistical purposes, but lining up countries that are purchasing advanced weapons from NATO countries to be used in actual warfare conditions, such as that against Syria 2 years ago. But I should mention this also, the Deputy Secretary of General of NATO currently, an American, Alexander Verzbaum, former ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Russia, by the way, stated a few days ago that if North Korea attacked the United States, which is, a nonsensical contention. But if it could be construed that North Korea had attacked the United States, and to be more accurate, that NATO would consider invoking its Article 5 Mutual Military Assistance Clause, and that the entire 28 members of NATO you mentioned, Steve, would go to war against North Korea with its Asia-Pacific allies like Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, and others.
Oh, indeed, Rick. I mean, imagine NATO coming to the defense of the United States. It sounds so oxymoronic to me.
Yeah, but in fact, the only time Article 5 has been invoked, and this accounts for NATO's first Asian war, its first ground war, the longest war in American history in Afghanistan, is after the events of 9/11 in the United States in 2001. NATO did invoke almost immediately the Article 5 so-called self-defense clause, or mutual defense clause, and not only did that serve as a basis for troops from 50 countries, I repeat, 50 countries serving under NATO command, the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. This is unprecedented history, by the way. People really ought to register that fact. But it also led to launching a so-called Operation Endeavor, Active Endeavor in the Mediterranean, which persists to this day, where NATO warships control the entire Mediterranean Sea from the Strait of Gibraltar, the Suez Canal, and the Bosporus. Straits of Dardanelles, rather, you know, to monitor the entire Mediterranean Sea. That's also done under Article 5 because of the attacks in the United States on 9/11, and on and on and on. The fact is, this is a global military threat to peace, and the fact that more people in NATO countries aren't calling for withdrawal from the alliance and abolition of this bloc. As a matter of fact, what we're seeing is the likelihood in September an independent Scotland will become the 29th member of NATO. So, and we're seeing perhaps Cyprus and other nations, Ireland, Sweden, Finland, being dragged in in the imminent future as full members of this military bloc. Anyway, I'm incensed about this, as you could tell by the tone of my voice. I am very concerned that people don't understand the magnitude of the threat posed by NATO.
Oh, absolutely, Rick. We should all be incensed about it. NATO has got nothing whatsoever to do with defense. It's all about offense. And I had no idea, Rick, that there were 50 countries involved in Afghanistan. They're not all there now. And I guess a great many of them put in very small contingents. But the idea that a country would send any of its forces to fight a war of aggression that's America's war, it never should have been fought. It's an illegal war. And yet this is going on in 50 countries. My God.
Yeah, 50. 50 countries, by the way, and there's some reason to believe the Colombian troops are there as well, which would be 51, and that would then mean that troops from every inhabited continent are serving under NATO command in Afghanistan. From every inhabited continent.
It is really incredible.
Again, I think people have been napping, since 1991, since the end of the Cold War and the dissolution of the Eastern Bloc, and they've allowed this the tentacles of this military beast creature to spread throughout the globe, and people are not calling it, and they're not recognizing it for what it is. But the fact that the second in command of NATO, an American, can get up, as we just talked about a moment ago, and threaten the three of the world's nuclear powers and nations that account for 70% of world military spending and might, will gang up on North Korea if the U.S. can, present even a quasi-plausible, prospect that North Korea is posing some kind of threat to it.
Oh, indeed, Rick. We've got about a minute or so left. I want to give it to you. Any other thoughts, any other issues on your mind that you'd like to raise with listeners?
I talked to somebody real quickly. We both live in Chicago. I was walking down Clark Street yesterday, and two young people came up and talked about the closing of the local elementary school, Trumbull, near my house. And we have to remember, in this city, they are closing dozens of schools, public schools. They are closing libraries. They are closing local medical and local mental health clinics, community hospitals. My own neighborhood, Edgewater and Ravenswood and others, have closed in recent years. The entire infrastructure that makes a city civilized is being destroyed, as the U.S. can spend anywhere from $650 to $728 billion a year on its war budget.
Indeed.
That is criminal.
Indeed, Rick, and what you just raised is something that I've written about, 120-odd schools being closed, 50-odd being closed this summer. It really is outrageous. Rick, thank you very much. It was great having you on. I look forward to getting you back. We will pick up on this story as events unfold. Indeed, Rick, I do hope we'll get together in this program again very soon.
Yeah, thank you again, Stephen. It's very much appreciated.
Join us again over the weekend, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.